Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A recent Ohio Supreme Court ruling means that Ohio will have two separate sex offender registry reporting systems, one for those convicted prior to 2008 and one for those convicted after 2008. Officials have said that 26,000 sex offenders statewide will have their classifications changed as a result. What are the ramifications? We've invited three guests to the show today to talk about that. First, State Senator Tim Grendel of the 18th Ohio District. Senator Grendel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. How does that that particular disputed section of the Adam Walsh Act make for a public, a safer public?
Well, the purpose of the Adam Walsh Act was to enhance the classification and notification requirements of sex offenders based on the severity of their underlying sexual offense for which they were convicted. The Supreme Court of Ohio has said that while our purpose was good, the legislature cannot order a court to change a final judgment. And those folks convicted before 2008 had gotten their classification and notification requirements under the old Megan's Law that we had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that a court had issued a final judgment ordering those pre-2008 sex offenders to be classified and registered under Megan's Law, the court said we could not enhance those final judgments because once the courts put them on a final judgment, they were beyond change by the legislature. So now we're going to have folks who will be classified and giving notification based on Megan's Law. And anybody convicted after 2008 will now have to abide by the classification and notification requirements of the Adam Walsh Act, which is a longer period of classification, having to give notification more often, and based on enhancement because of the nature of their sexual offense.
Now, the Ohio Supreme Court said that this was unconstitutional because it overturned final trial court decisions, like you said, and therefore violated separations of powers doctrine. You're a lawyer.
Right.
The separation of powers doctrine is pretty fundamental. Do you agree or what?
I agree with the dissent, which was written by Judge Cuff, mm-hmm. that we weren't changing the final judgment. We are simply changing the administrative classification requirement under the statute.
Well, if the penalty is changed, doesn't that change the nature of the final judgment?
Well, it wasn't the penalty, though. The Supreme Court of Ohio, in prior cases under the Megan's Law, had ruled that the sexual classification was not a penalty. It was not part of the penalty phase like incarceration or probation. So we were operating under the premise that it was still the sort of administrative requirement. However, I can appreciate where the Supreme Court ruling is. My wife was a Court of Appeals judge.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, she had ruled in her case was consistent with the Supreme Court's decision. We had a little separation of powers difference in our own household, and she won this round. But I mean, I understand the Supreme Court's position that once a court issues a final judgment, whether it's a penalty or it's a administrative requirement, whatever it is, if it's in a final judicial ruling, that's final. And it's just like if you got a speeding ticket and the legislature changed the fines for speeding tickets, the courts can't go back and add more fines. So I understand where the Supreme Court was at. But we, our goal was a good one. We want to make sure the public is protected from these sexual offenders to the maximum level we can do it, you know, under the Constitution. And at least going forward, I believe the enhanced requirements will be more protective than the requirements of Megan's Law. But the good news is the Supreme Court left in place all the classification and notification requirements mm-hmm. of those pre-2008 sex offenders under Megan's Law. So it wasn't like they're just allowed to walk the streets. They still have to, you know, be classified. They still have to give notification.
As they would have before
Correct.
The Adam Walsh Act. When it comes to the issue of penalty and how we define a penalty, I get that we are not talking about jail time or a prison sentence here. That's what's defined as the penalty phase, right?
Right. Well, the loss of liberty is the penalty.
Loss
phase,
of liberty. Right? So the way when you put it that way, it makes it even more relevant. Is it not a loss of liberty to have to register on a regular basis and have to be you know, you have to report like that in some cases for the rest of your life to the local law enforcement agency, the sheriff's department?
That's what the lawyers for the sex offenders have argued, but interestingly enough, the Ohio Supreme Court and other courts have ruled no, that simply having to register and give notification does not rise to the level of a loss of liberty that would constitute a penalty. And there's been much debate about this and much litigation about this, and the courts have been consistent that it's not a penalty as would be incarceration or probation or community service or community control. I think it's fair to note, though, that the Ohio Supreme Court has not ruled completely on the constitutionality of the Adam Walsh Act. This case was limited to pre-2008 offenders, folks who had been classified prior to the adoption of the Adam Walsh Act and had been given their final judicial sentencing. The issue of whether or not going forward is constitutional or whether or not people who were convicted but not sentenced, convicted before the Adam Walsh Act but sentenced after, whether that was constitutional, those two issues are still pending before the Ohio Supreme Court. And I'm sure they're going to rule on them in some other cases here in the next year or so.
Right. You've said that, well, before we move on, I just want to let our listeners know that we are talking about Ohio's sex offender registration law. It's the new one and the old one, the Adam Walsh-inspired one and the Megan, no, I forgot her last name.
Megan's Law. Yeah.
Megan's Law, right. There is no last name in that one. Megan's Law, the one that the Ohio previously embraced. With State Senator Tim Grendel of the 18th Ohio District, you've said that lawmakers are going to review the decision to see if further changes are needed in the wake of this Ohio Supreme Court ruling. What sort of factors are you going to assess?
The goal is to see if there's any way we can statutorily provide for non-criminal requirements for these pre-Adam Walsh convicted individuals so as not to be stepping upon the finality of those judicial rulings. And that probably sounds like a lot of legalese, but
it is.
The bottom line is we're trying to see if there's something we can do to still put some further registration requirements on them that does not step on the final judicial ruling. And we've got some folks doing research this summer to see if that's possible. I've got my doubts, but it's still worth looking at.
I'm going to have a chief deputy from the Franklin County Sheriff's Office on after you, and I have no idea how he's going to respond to this. There's no local, I have no idea, you know, what they think, but doesn't the Adam Walsh Act kind of pile on to the law enforcement agencies that have to enforce these registration laws and have to hunt down these guys who aren't registering as they should be and who have to protect the public?
Both Megan's Law and Adam Walsh mm-hmm. Act increase the burden on local sheriffs, particularly to have to administer the notification program. Registration program. That has been something that I believe the legislature needs to address in the bill to help with the local funding of this. We have not found that source. One of the reasons for passing the Adam Walsh Act in Ohio was the state to actually pass it as a state law was to get additional federal funding so we could help get it to the local sheriffs to cover the administrative costs. Unfortunately, the federal government has not the money, and that is a problem. But I do have sympathies for the sheriff. On the other hand, the sheriffs I know are all good folks, and they mm-hmm. want to protect the public. And this is one of those duties that has been thrust upon them to help us protect the public. And so while I'm sympathetic to the plight, I'm also appreciative of doing part of their law enforcement job to get this program to continue to operate.
As you said a little earlier, state compliance with the Adam Walsh Act was linked to federal funding. States that didn't implement the law by July 27 or get an extension risk losing 10% in federal crime-fighting funds. Now, that was my understanding, is that you risk losing federal crime-fighting funds. You're saying that passage of it initially was supposed to bring in more money?
Right. The way it was set up, if you passed it within the first year, you got 10% more. You got a bonus of 10%.
Okay.
If you passed it in the second year, you got the level funding, And if you didn't get it passed by the second year, you lost 10%.
And you're
so
saying they haven't come through.
Time for the 10%, but we haven't seen the fund.
Do you know what that was going to amount to, the 10%? How many millions?
It was a large number. I can't give it specific, but it was millions.
And that was promised by the previous administration? Was that part of that? Yeah, that was signed in 2006, right?
Right. It was promised by the Adam Walsh Act itself. But there was a federal statute called the Adam Walsh Act that put this all in play, came up with this new three-tiered system, came up with this as an incentive to the states to adopt the concept at the state level. The federal government said if you do it by this date, you get 10% more, and we did it by that date, and unfortunately, the federal government hasn't shown up with the money.
Now, the fact that the Ohio Supreme Court's made this ruling in this part of the law, does that affect, let's say hypothetically, that the federal government does come through with the money, does that affect the state's standing for that?
Well, that's what we're looking at. I'm afraid it might. I mean, you know, the full compliance with the act was the requirement. We fully complied. Now the Supreme Court has said part of this is not constitutional. So one of the other things we are doing now is in discussions with the federal government to find out, does this affect our qualification for that federal fund? I do note that many states did not pass the Adam Walsh Act to this day because of concerns about the juvenile offender problem.
Right.
And I just saw where the Obama administration is now changing or recommending changing some of the Adam Walsh Act compliance dealing with the juvenile. So this thing's a little fluid, and we're going to have to see how it all washes out.
Right. I guess the changes to the proposed changes would let states decide whether to include teen offenders in their public registries or not.
Right. And that was quite a controversial issue when we were passing the Ohio version of the act. There's a lot of discussion on that point, but now I think another discussion point is going to be if how can they expect us to do something our Supreme Court has said was unconstitutional as a condition to getting their money? I'm hopeful that we're going to prevail here, that we're still entitled to the money, because frankly, as you're going to find out from the sheriffs you're going to talk to, they're underfunded on this thing.
Right. If it's unconstitutional at the state level, is it possibly unconstitutional at the federal level?
Well, I mean, theoretically, you could be unconstitutional under the state constitution, but not the federal.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that. So, in fact, the Ohio Constitution does not contain a specific separation of powers provision, but the U.S. Constitution does.
Okay.
But the Ohio Supreme Court, over 100 and some years ago, adopted the federal concept of separation of powers into Ohio law. So I think the short answer is if it's unconstitutional under the state, it's unconstitutional under the feds.
Okay. Senator Tim Grendel, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will be with Chief Deputy Stephen Martin of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. If you want a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page at All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, On Point will be here. China's economy is barreling ahead. Europe is in crisis. And U.S. in the United States is in a muddle. Across the world, free market economies are being challenged by state capitalism. On Point discusses that horse race at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Sunshine today, a high of 82 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Sunshine for Friday. There is a slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 88. Clouds and rain for Saturday and a high of 85. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio's sex offender registration law. It is now called the, it's now based on the Adam Walsh Act. It used to be based on Megan's Law. Things change. Joining us in this segment is Chief Deputy Stephen Martin of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office to talk about how it affects us locally. Welcome to the show, Chief.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate it.
Well, reverting to the old classification, a la the Ohio Supreme Court ruling or recent ruling, make your job easier or not necessarily?
Well, you know what? It's something that we are currently looking at about how we're going to re-register a lot of these people. We will take a lot of our direction not only from the Attorney General but also from the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office. when we went from the Megan's Law to Adam Walsh Act, it increased our workload significantly. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to have to go back and look at this and redo this again. I'm not sure what impact it will have on us, other than we're going to have to change probably 600 or 700 of our registrants back to their original under the original Megan's Law. So that in itself will be a paper chase, and so we'll have to be working through that issue.
When you said it increased your workload significantly a couple years ago when the law changed in Ohio, do you mean that the administrative technicality of changing over the classifications increased your workload, or just overall now you had a lot more people on the rolls?
Well, actually what it did is, by classification change, it made some people that under the old Megan's Law were sexually orientated, for example, which means that they only had to come in once every year for 10 years. But when their file was reviewed, some of those people were kicked up to a Tier 3. That's under the Adam Walsh Act, which means that they had to come in every 90 days for the rest of their life. So, you know, we had a lot more people coming in here a lot more frequently because of the change from Megan's to Adam Walsh.
And also, when they changed the law a couple years ago, one of the deals about that was that it was going to bring in 10% more federal crime-fighting funds, and the money never arrived, and I imagine it never arrived for you guys either.
That's absolutely correct. From day one, when we started doing this in the late 70s, I think we started in 76, if I'm not mistaken, this has been an unfunded mandate. I currently have two full-time secretaries, four detectives, and a sergeant that work in our SORN unit right now. It is with that and with our mailings that we have to do, especially under the Adam Walsh Act, we had an enormous increase. So what we did is we opted to go with a company to do the automatic community notifications for us. Plus, we also maintain a website, and we also send, not it costs a lot of money, all of our information to the Ohio Attorney General's Office, Richard Cordray, because they have a website also. So, you know, that's all for community notification. But it takes personnel and time and, you know, money and stuff to do that. You know, all these people have cars, gasoline, you know, insurance. You know, we pay a lot of overtime to do knock and talks to make sure that our tier threes, for example, which will be back to the sexual predator now, that they're living where they're saying they're living and those issues.
Right. How much does all of this cost? What is your annual budget?
You know, I would say we're someplace pretty close to with the salaries, and we pay about mm-hmm. $300,000 a year in mailing. I'm saying we're probably between $850,000 to $900,000 a year. Just for that unit.
Including
that
salaries
squad.
And just for that
yeah,
unit.
Just for that squad, yes.
Some folks have said, law enforcement folks have said, that this dilutes, when you have so many people on the rolls, it dilutes your ability to really stay on top of the really bad dudes out there. The child sex predators, the serial rapists, that sort of thing.
Well, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's not a tremendous job that we've been tasked with doing. You know, the county commissioners have been very good with us. We've made some compelling cases as far as some overtime monies to make sure that we're current with our checks, and that, you know, we're filing warrants for people that are out of compliance on a regular basis. And so, you know, we've made our pleas to the county commissioners for additional funding, and they've been gracious enough to do that. It is a tough job. There's no question about it. But I think we do a great job. And these laws affect primarily the really large counties, you know, the
right.
Hamiltons and Franklins and Cuyahoga and Summit, you know, mm-hmm. Montgomery counties, where we have the majority of the predators.
You know, around the country, not just in Ohio, there's plenty of evidence now that the tougher laws, as they've evolved over the last probably 15 years or so, I'd say, the more restrictive residency laws, for example, have had unintended consequences. For example, when sex offenders are restricted as to where they can live, sex offender ghettos are created. Has that been the case in Columbus or in Franklin County?
You know, I don't think there's any question about that. You know, when you look at our mapping and stuff like that, if you're looking at doing something with us, you can go to a zip code and put that in there, and it will tell you all of the predators, all the registrants that are within that particular zip code. And you can actually plan that out and see. And we've had some complaints. Well, why are they living here? Well, you know, I don't know, but maybe it's because it's affordable.
And it's not within 100 yards of something.
Right, yeah. Within 1,000 yards of a school and stuff like that. Right, right.
So in some ways, does that make your job easier? You know where they're all at? They're all in the same place.
But I'll also tell you, I've been doing this for 39 years in law enforcement, and it's my opinion, and I'm not asking anybody to agree or not agree. Mm-hmm. But if you're an offender, it doesn't make any difference where you live at. If you're going to reoffend, you're going to reoffend, whether it's 10 foot or 10 miles. So I mean, that's how I see it. But to answer your question, yeah, we have certain areas where we have an inordinate amount of registrants there.
And also another unintended consequence because of the restrictions is in some places, at least, I don't know if it's the case with Franklin County, but more and more sex offenders are falling off the rolls. They're going underground because they can't handle the 90-day requirements or whatever it might be. They can't handle not being able to live in certain places. For instance, sometimes with their families who want to take them in but can't because of the residential restrictions. Do you see any of that in Franklin County?
You know, I don't think it's epidemic with us, but yes, we do see it. And we see a number of issues. You know, one of the things with, at least from a law enforcement perspective, is that a lot of times people, the legislature will pass these laws without any input from the law enforcement community and say, okay, you have to do this. And then it's up to us to figure out how we're going to do it. And second of all, how we're going to pay for it. One of the loopholes in the law is we have some people that, for example, are registered underneath the Broad Street Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
They're homeless. We don't have any recourse with those people. We ask them to come in every day and just say, I'm still living underneath the Broad Street Bridge, for example. But, you know, we have some homeless people out there that do not have residence, but we have no recourse as far as, you know, we can't lock them up because you can't afford a house. So there's a number of issues that really need to be looked at as far as registration is concerned. So we face a number of issues when we're registering people and trying to keep track of them.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Chief Deputy Stephen Martin of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. We're talking about Ohio's sex offender registry law and how it affects folks like the chief in the bigger counties especially. If you have a question or comment for the chief, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We're always ready, willing, and able to take your comments and questions.
You know, Ann, one of the other things that at least myself personally would wish that have happened when they started doing this is when the federal government mandated all 50 states have some form of Megan's Law. The federal government, in my opinion, should have taken the lead on this and said, here's the way it's going to be done. So consequently, what we have is we have 50 states that do it completely different. We run into that issue all the time when we have a registrant that, for example, that would come from Texas to Ohio. What he or she has been charged with down there, we have to try to make that fit into what our was Adam Walsh, now back to Megan's Law, but we have to make that fit. So, you know, we're constantly subpoenaing documents, court documents from other states and things like that to make sure that we put them in the right category. So that's an additional expense that we have to do also. We should be doing it uniformly across the country. I think that would have been a much better system to do.
It kind of reminds me of the child support enforcement issue back in the day, right?
Yeah, well, we still do that.
Yeah, we still have problems with that too. How much do the states work together, how much do the different sheriff's departments or sheriff's offices work together in Ohio?
You know, I think it's pretty seamless in Ohio. We, like, for example, if I call up, I don't know, you know, Henry County, for example, mm-hmm. I say, you know, and our people would get a hold of the clerks up there and say, how about send me, the sentencing sheet or whatever. Atypically, they will fax that down to us. Now, with Florida, unless you send money, they're not sending it. So, So I think in the state of Ohio, we work well together. I think it makes a lot of sense to have one agency per county to do this because it keeps it compartmentalized. So I think that makes a lot of sense to do it that way. Even though it's a burden on the sheriffs, it still makes all the sense because, as you're well aware of, you know, the sheriff's office is the chief law enforcement agency in a county, mm-hmm. and we're not restricted by boundaries. So it makes sense to do it that way. But like I said, you know, in Ohio, I think we cooperate with each other very well. It's with some of the other states that it takes us time to get documents from them, things like
well,
that.
Well, and I wonder how confident are you that other states, when a sex offender registrant moves to another state, that the other states are following up properly, particularly the poorer states that don't even have the funds that Franklin County does?
You know what? I can't tell. I don't know. I don't know if they're as aggressive as that what we are in Franklin County as far as how we manage our program here. You know, that I can't tell you. I don't know if they put the same resources that we do into this, but once again, I can tell you that, you know, our funding source, the commissioners, recognizes this as being a significant community issue and have funded us accordingly. Would I like to have 10 more people? Yeah. In real world, is that going to work? No.
You know, after the law passed in the Megan's Law passed, did – like the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association get together and work this out together to create this seamless atmosphere, this seamless bureaucracy?
You know, they had, what they did is that, you know, they have a role in this. I don't think there's any question about it. But one of the things that I can say for Franklin County is when we were first tasked with doing this, I think most people saw that this was going to be a problem with us. And we developed a database right off the bat. And so for the first couple of years, and at least at the Ohio Attorney General's Conference, we would go down and present how we were registering people and how we were keeping track of them at that time. So we gave a number of different sheriff's offices a CD with how we do things and everything. And so we've continued to refine our process. But we were right on top of that. Right now, as soon as they said, here's what you're going to do, mm-hmm. we got together with our IT staff and we said, we need to have a program here. So, you know, it was continually tweaked as we got more persons. For example, when we first started to do the mailings, we did them ourselves. So we bought an automatic mailing machine, which was probably $40,000 or $50,000, and we used inmate labor. We used the individuals in the county jail that had been sentenced for minor crimes or DUIs or whatever. And these all they did was stuff envelopes and, you know, and put them in by zip code into the mailing boxes. And then our staff would take them out to the post office, the airport, and we mailed them bulk-wise out there to try to save some money. Well, it got to the point where it got overwhelming because our secretaries and stuff, that's all they were doing was mailing every day instead of, you know, doing a lot of the paperwork and all filing and stuff like that for us. So that's when we opted to go with electronic mailing. Out of, I believe it's Louisiana. It's called Watch System. They do a phenomenal job for us, and they have a great, we do everything electronically with them, so there's a lot of savings on paper and stuff like that.
614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment, we have a few more minutes with Chief Deputy Stephen Martin of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. Joe, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Interesting conversation I've been listening to between the two of you. I have to say that I know the Franklin County Sheriff's Office have limited resources and monies, but I seems, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, it seems as if I'm hearing a little complaining, shall we say, that, you know, since this law has changed and they have to re-register every 90 days, that we don't have, you know, of all the things that we spend tax dollars for, I can't imagine a better one than tracking these repeated sexual offenders.
They're not all repeated sexual offenders, but Chief, what do you say to that?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not complaining. Absolutely not. You know, we have a job to do, and that's exactly what we will do, and we're mandated to do that. what we will do is, like we do anything when there's a major legislative change, and sir, this is we get changes all the time. We just got Senate Bill 77, which is going to create a whole other issue as far as evidentiary issues are concerned for criminal cases. So we're looking at how we're going to do that and how much more money it's going to cost us. But that's another legislative change. What we will do is we will evaluate if it's going to reduce the amount of time that we have to spend on registering people in SORN, or if it's going to increase it. That's something we'll have to take a look at, keeping in mind that for a long time we registered under Megan's Law, so we're very familiar with how that's done. So, and if at some point in time it becomes a personnel issue or an equipment issue, then we'll make our case to our funding source, the commissioners. So I can't really say at this time, until we get the data from the Attorney General's office, how this will affect our operation. But I can tell you one thing, we'll be able to handle it.
Okay. I just hope that, I'm one that's not for new taxes, but if we have to have some additional tax revenue to get the job done, I'd be all for that, because, most of these people that are caught, we know that it's not their first time. It's just the first time they've been caught. And it also has been proven that most likely they will reoffend. And so anybody that has a child or children in the neighborhood, we want to know who they are. And if nonetheless, if drunk drivers, repeated drunk drivers can have a special plate, that's something that I've thought for a long time we should look into, that sexual offenders could have a special license plate so we can identify them.
All righty, Joe, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Take another quick call on this while you're on the phone, Chief. Ann, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. We're going to take a break real quick, but I wanted to get you on with the Chief. Hello, Ann?
Yes.
Okay.
The housing is very much more specific. I used to live in part of Old Town East, and we got notices almost every day, and they were almost all out of one building.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in affordable neighborhoods all over town, and I've never received as many notices as I did in this one specific location. And I was under the impression that guys were being referred there by their POs. I may not be correct in that.
Their parole officers?
Either from their POs or from other fellows that they had run into. Because this building, we thought it was a halfway house when we moved into the neighborhood, because it was so specifically to this one address.
Chief, is that something that, if you are a sex, if you are limited on where you can live, is that something that a parole officer would help somebody with as far as finding a place they can live?
You know something, I think that would better be, and probably better served by talking to somebody from
right.
parole and probation. Once again, I'm only speculating, which is probably not a good thing to do, but I think that could be one of the responsibilities of a parole officer, is if one of their one of their parolees or probationers need some assistance or something. I know they try to help them. They help to get them in a work, in a job, and things like that. But also to address that question, every day here at 410 South High Street, where my headquarters is at, on our third floor, is where the registrants come to re-register and verify addresses and things like that. So what you have there is you have these men and women. They talk to each other out there in the lobby all the time. So that's, in my mind, wouldn't be unusual if they say, well, where are you living at? It's affordable, those kind of issues. Because they're complaining and they're talking and they're out in the lobby every
right.
day before they come in. So
right.
they have their own interaction. So, and I guess if somebody's having a success or living someplace and it's reasonable and they tell another guy, that he or she may want to look at it.
Ann, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. We got to take a break now. Chief Deputy Stephen Martin of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, I know you're really busy, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Okay.
We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
As a second-generation business owner, new father, and musician at night, keeping informed about the world is necessary and difficult. Whether it's Terry Gross at lunch, Bluegrass Ramble on the weekend, or the BBC at night, WOSU is always on my radio. This is Matthew Sullivan, and WOSU is my source for the information I need to be an informed business owner and father, and the entertainment and music I need to unwind my busy brain.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here. We'll hear about efforts to address the childhood obesity epidemic in Ohio by providing healthier options in school foods and beverage vending machines, including the 2010 Healthy Choices for Healthy Children Act. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Remember, you can get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen online at WOSU.org. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41. Sunshine today, a high right around 82. Clear skies tonight, a low of 60. Sunshine and a chance of rain on Friday, a high of 88. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll continue our discussion about Ohio's sex offender registration law, how it's changed and how it may change in the future. Joining us now is Margie Slagle. She is a staff attorney with the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Margie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Good morning.
Just in general, your view of the Ohio sex offender registration law?
Well, I think that the primary question that no one has yet addressed is does it protect our children? And if you look at the statistics and if you talk to victims' rights advocates from across the country, the answer is no.
Why not? What's wrong with it?
Well, specifically with the Adam Walsh Act, everybody's being lumped based upon their offense, not based upon whether or not they're a risk to reoffend. There's the first problem. Unfortunately, Joe is very mistaken when he was saying earlier that all these people are going to reoffend, and we know if you catch them once, they've done it before. That's absolutely not true. That is not what the research shows. What the research shows is that most sex offenders will not reoffend. What the research shows is that 93% of all sex offenses that do occur against children, it occurs because the parents have trusted their children with the wrong person.
It's not a stranger, in other words.
It's not a stranger. Stranger abductions are incredibly rare. Stranger sex offending is incredibly rare. The way that it ordinarily, 93% of the times here in Ohio, is that the offender gains the trust of the parents. The parents allow the children to spend time with the offender, whether it's a teacher, a coach, a babysitter, an uncle, a grandfather, whatever. And that person offends against the child. Now, we do know that there's a way to prevent that. There's a program called Darkness to Light, and it is scientifically proven to reduce offenses against children. And the primary way that it works is to teach parents what the warning signs are and to teach parents what to look for and how to protect their children.
So Darkness to Light and other programs like that, they're not being used already?
Very few people are aware of them. A lot of parents, like Joe, they think, oh, if I just look at my postcard and I look at the registry, I'm protecting my child.
Well, there is the assumption, I find, and I corrected him at the time, it doesn't mean they're repeat offenders. They've just been convicted and are, you know, registered because of the conviction. It doesn't mean they did it before. But there's always this assumption that the sex offenders are child molesters.
Right, and that's absolutely false. There are some sex offenders who are child molesters, but most of them aren't.
Most of them are what? What do we know about the makeup of the registry?
I don't think that statistically we know anything, to be honest with you. I've never seen a statistical breakdown. When you're dealing with an offense like a rape charge, it's usually an adult. An adult has offended against an adult.
What do you make of the Supreme Court ruling regarding the before and after categories?
Well, I think from a constitutional perspective, it was the correct decision. What I wish would happen at this point, having two different systems is very, very confusing. And this new federal system is not as effective or as evidence-based as our old system was. I'd much prefer that the judges who have just heard the criminal case make the decision as to whether the person is a high risk or a low risk to reoffend. The judges would have individualized assessments, psychological evaluations, and expert opinion.
Instead of just basing it on a category.
Yes, yes.
Well, if you just base it on a category, doesn't that at least, you know, catch as many fish in the net as you can? And, you know, too bad if some of them aren't necessarily what the law was intended to restrict or control, at least you're controlling more?
Well, all it does is waste a heck of a lot of money, as Chief Martin discussed, how much money they have to spend. But it also makes it difficult for parents. You know, if you dilute the registry and if you say, you know, there's, for example, 1,000 dangerous sex offenders here in Hamilton County, well, they're not all dangerous. So what am I supposed to do? And then you can't, if as a parent, you do want to know who might be a danger to your child. I can't tell that by looking and seeing that somebody's a tier three. I can't even really tell that if the person's called a predator. And the reason is I don't know the facts and circumstances of the crime.
And the registry, doesn't it give you some facts and tell you if the victim was under the age of?
It might say child victim, or sometimes it'll say youth and sometimes adult. But the thing that a lot of parents don't understand is, let's say it says youth. Well, then you have to do the math. And oftentimes when you do the math, what you're going to see is that the person who offended against the youth was also a youth at the time.
We have an email from Paul, and State Senator Tim Grindel, when he was on in the first segment, did talk about the juvenile sex offenders issue and how contentious that's been for states trying to implement the Adam Walsh Protection and Safety Act. This email is from Paul. He asks, are two minor children who engage in consensual sex considered sexual offenders? If so, at what level and how long will that information stay on their records? For example, a couple of high school kids.
Not anymore in Ohio. Depending on their ages.
And we're thinking of the typical, you know, I mean, you hate to generalize, but yeah, 16, 17, 18-year-olds.
As long as the younger of the two is at least 13 and there's less than a four-year age difference, then they are not considered sex offenders. But if there's 4 years and 1 day age difference, then yes, somebody's a sex offender, even if it is consensual.
Now, that's not anymore. They were lumped in, weren't they?
Yes, yes. This is the, I call it the Romeo and Juliet exception. And that was a new, that was an addition. That came into force on January 1st, 2008 as part of Ohio's Adam Walsh Act.
We have an email from Ron. I don't know if this will apply to you, Margie, but let's listen. Let's read it. I live in one of Columbus's neighborhoods in transition. There is a mix of people, some longtime residents and some like us who purchased for love of old brick homes with great architecture. My neighborhood is definitely a sex offender ghetto. 2 to 4 times a week, I get sex offender notices in my mailbox, all for addresses on South Wilson or South Champion. Are there official halfway houses on these streets? Do you know, I mean, what that has been a problem. We talked about the sex offender ghettos. There's no place to live anymore.
Right. There's a lot of different things going on. The residency restriction doesn't apply retroactively, first of all. So anyone who was convicted before July of 2003 can live anywhere they want. The problem is, once a landlord sees your name on a list, they're not going to rent to you. So there's very few places that will rent to you. Once an employer sees your name on a list, you will not be hired or you will be fired. Keep in mind that sex offenders who do have jobs, the address of their employer is on the Internet. So if you don't have a job, how can you afford a home?
Is that required in the law as well?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yes. And it's wreaked havoc. Quite frankly, for community safety purposes, I would like every former sex offender to succeed in the community and never commit another offense. If that happens, we're all safer.
Are we safer if they succeed in the community?
Yes. That means they don't reoffend. They're succeeding in the community, hopefully gainfully employed, raising families, living their lives, which is what most of them wish to do. They don't want to reinvent.
But
when you won't hire them, most sex offenders, they have a very low recidivism rate for committing another sex offense.
Most.
There is one small subsection of individuals who do reoffend at higher rates. Those are folks who were diagnosed with pedophilia, and they are attracted to prepubescent boys. That subgroup has a higher rate of recidivism.
Recidivism meaning they will repeat offend, but it's also a very low rate of prosecution against them. They're very rarely caught.
That's exactly right. Most of the new people who are caught each and every day are not on the list and have never been on the list.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about Ohio's sex offender registration law with Margie Slagle. She's a staff attorney with the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. If you want to go to our Facebook page, you can do that as well, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And my ever-vigilant associate producer, Amy Jurevich, will check that out, too. 614-292-8513, though, if you want to talk with Margie right now. Margie, there are other issues with the sex registration laws. Can you talk about what some of those other objections are? There's, I think, at least two of them are being argued or have been argued or are pending in the Ohio Supreme Court now.
Some of the stuff pending in the Ohio Supreme Court is going to become moot now.
Because of
their decision. One of the cases that was pending is whether or not offenders should have the right to an attorney when they challenge this reclassification. Well, they're not going to have to decide that now.
Okay.
There are still two cases they haven't decided with respect to juveniles.
And that's not just, what is that?
Specifically, one case is basically all the constitutional issues with respect to juveniles. The Ninth District Court of Appeals out in California has already said that the sex offender registry is unconstitutional as applied to juveniles.
Why is that?
Because juveniles are treated very, very differently than adults. The purpose with the juvenile system is to rehabilitate, to allow these children to get the treatment that they need, get the therapy they need, and move forward as responsible adults. A lot of times the juvenile records, you can get them sealed so that your juvenile adjudication doesn't impact the rest of your life. We know that juveniles, their brains are different than adults. They have less self-control, less impulse control. And with respect to juveniles, we try to protect them and rehabilitate them.
Is rehabilitation more successful with juveniles?
Rehabilitation is more successful with all sex offenders.
Except that narrow subgroup.
Even with that narrow subgroup, they have a higher recidivism rate, but that does not mean that all of them commit another sex offense. Many of them can also be successfully treated. Unfortunately, Ohio does not provide the necessary treatment for the sex offenders to help them succeed.
It's very expensive.
So are these postcards. And the question becomes, we have a limited amount of money. Where can we put this money to truly reduce sex offending against children? That's a conversation that we should be having statewide. I would love to see Senator Grendel convene a group of experts to discuss that question and come up with evidence-based solutions. I would love to see Senator Grendel get victims' rights advocates, sex offender treatment providers, the sheriffs, attorneys together in a group, adult parole authority, and sit down and have the conversation.
About curing the disease versus punishing the offender.
Well, about protecting the public.
Okay.
There's the two greatest ways to protect the public is to educate the parents. That's the first way. You know, we talked about the fact that oftentimes, you know, the pedophiles do reoffend. Well, if parents knew some of the warning signs to look for, they might be able to prevent it. And then the second thing we need to do is to make certain that the offenders are treated. They get the treatment that they need. And the third way also, we need to make sure that all the victims get treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three primary things we could do as a state that would better protect all of us.
The current law, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the current law requires sex offenders who completed their prior sentences but commit a new crime, even if it's not a sex-related crime, to register again.
No.
Is that not in the law?
It has to be a sex crime.
Okay.
All right.
They're reviewing, this U.S. Supreme Court ruled in May that federal officials can indefinitely hold inmates considered sexually dangerous.
Yes.
After their prison terms are complete.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
I thought that was an incorrect decision. I don't think it's the role of the federal government to civilly commit. I think that's the role of the states to make that determination. But the problem I have with the whole idea of civil commitment is that they're not really getting the appropriate treatment. Once you get in, you don't get out. And it's being overused. I know that one of the individuals in the case that went up to the Supreme Court, I believe he had looked at child pornography.
Mm-hmm.
He had not offended against a child. Now, I find it difficult to believe that the community is best served by spending a ton of money civilly committing this person instead of having him out in the community but getting treatment.
How do you define sexually dangerous? Is it a legal definition?
I don't think there's a legal definition. The way that Ohio defined it under the old laws is whether or not you're at a higher risk to reoffend.
Okay.
And there are many, many treatment providers who specialize in treating sex offenders. And we have some fabulous treatment out there. The statistics show that it works, that the individuals who get the appropriate treatment are far less likely to commit another sex offense.
Okay. That's all the time we have, Margie. I want to thank you, Margie Slagle, staff attorney for the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That's all the time we have for this hour of All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins today at noon. On today's edition of the program, internal documents point to BP's repeated disregard for safety and environmental rules. A discussion with an investigative reporter for ProPublica who got access to these documents. He's been investigating both oil and gas drilling. That discussion on Fresh Air at noon. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Outlook Media, publishers of Ohio's GLBT magazine, Outlook Columbus, containing local and national features, plus a monthly mix of columns and more for the progressive and gay communities. Online at OutlookMedia.com.
75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1 minute before 11 o'clock. Sunshine today and a high of 82. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60. Sunshine for Friday, there is a slight chance of rain and a high of 88. And then clouds and rain looking ahead to Saturday. This is WOSU 820. Good morning.
Childhood obesity is an epidemic in Ohio. Many schools are moving from a role in the problem to a role in the cure with healthier menus and limited or no access to vending machine junk. We'll talk about those issues and challenges and also Ohio's 2010 Healthy Choices for Healthy Children Act with a suburban school chef, a big city school district food coordinator, a lawmaker, and others in a few minutes on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.